Ah, those diets. They can help us take the weight off. But how long can we keep it off?
The goal of Make Weight Loss Last is to not think in terms of diet, 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 rigid, regimented, burn calories way of eating and living, but simply to move your body and enjoy the experience of eating, period. So you're not living in a stress-filled way.
That's nutritionist Deborah Keston. She shares the results of her research into losing weight and keeping it off. Her book is Make Weight Loss Last. Then, a story from yours truly about a master chef's philosophy about food. And finally, we hear a book review / interview from Writer's Voice co-producer Drew Adamack. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. The holidays are upon us again, and with them, plenty of chance to gain weight. Many of us will go on a diet after the holidays are over, and maybe we'll lose those extra pounds. But often, they creep back on. We all know it's easier to lose weight than to keep it off. So how can we make weight loss last? That's the subject of my guest, nutritionist Deborah Keston's book, Make Weight Loss Last, 10 Solutions That Nourish Mind, Body, and Soul. Co-written with her husband, Larry Sherwitz, Make Weight Loss Last says we need to forget about counting calories and focus on changing the whole way we relate to food. We need to make eating more pleasurable, pay more attention to our food when we eat, and share meals with others. Keston gained insights from traditional societies, spiritual traditions, and scientific research, as well as from her experience as a nutritionist for heart health doctor and diet guru Dean Ornish. Deborah Keston shares those insights with us just in time for the holidays. Deborah Keston, welcome to Writer's Voice. Now, you actually were a nutritionist on Dean Ornish's, the diet guru Dean Ornish's first clinical trial of his diet. Is that correct?
That is correct. And what Dean Ornish did was groundbreaking. He took what is called a yogic lifestyle, which many people aren't too aware of, though he writes about it in his books. He took a yoga lifestyle, and he put heart patients on what I describe as a no-fat-added plant-based diet, because heart patients very often have trouble metabolizing fat. And he did exercise and stress management. In his case, that was yoga and meditation, and also showed social support. And through these four lifestyle elements, he showed you could actually reverse buildup of plaque in the arteries.
So give us a sense of how did it go for you from treating heart disease to dealing with the obesity epidemic?
Wonderful question. I have been observing over the decades that no matter what I say or many other health experts say, the obesity epidemic continues to escalate. And I'm sure you and your listeners know that more than two-thirds now of Americans are either overweight or obese. And I've been looking around trying to find out and figure out, well, what can I say, what can I do? What are the magic words to help put this together to help people? And I got my first clue from a very unusual situation. I was invited to present at the first international conference on lifestyle and health in New Delhi, India. And one of the presenters there was a cardiologist named Dr. K.L. Chopra, who is the father and mentor of well-known author Deepak Chopra. And I was writing for magazines at the time. I've written over 300 articles about nutrition and health for magazines. And I asked him about Dr. Chopra, about yoga and diet. And his response changed my life forever. He said, prana, which is the Sanskrit word for vital life force, the mystery of life, prana is infused into food, and when you consume the food, you ingest the consciousness with which the food was prepared. And he said this belief that he's sharing with me is coming from the Bhagavad Gita, Hindu scripture. And when when I left the interview, I thought, here is a clinical cardiologist talking about healing with love and cooking with love, and he's talking about Hinduism, a 3,500-year-old religion. And I thought, if Hinduism espouses this, surely other world religions and what I call cultural traditions have figured this out also. And so I went on what I call a nutrition journey around the world, studying, it's nutritional anthropology, if you have to put an academic umbrella over it, and it's not something I'm just kind of making up as a magic Deborah diet. And I looked at what, how, where, with whom we ate for thousands of years based on world religions and cultural traditions such as the yogic nutrition, and also looked at African-American soul food, Japanese way of tea, certainly the Mediterranean diet, Native American food beliefs, and as importantly, looked at Eastern healing systems that include nutrition, such as Ayurveda and traditional Chinese medicine, Tibetan medicine, and Francesca, I put all this together and came up with 6 perennial principles that have been consistent over time. And to finally answer your question, how did I link this to obesity, did a research project with more than 10,000 people using the Spirituality and Health magazine website, and found out that when you eat based on what, how, where, with whom we ate for thousands of years, you eat less and lose weight, and that's how all of this came together.
You identify a number of, you know, dysfunctional ways in which people eat, and I'm just going to disclose right away, I'm one of the multitasking eaters. I have a really hard time eating without reading a book, and because I'm such a bibliophile. So today, just before I spoke with you, I decided I was going to try to eat mindfully, which is one of the things you suggest, without reading a book, just concentrating on my food. And you know what you say about the prana force was immediately apparent to me. I didn't think about it in that way, but I was amazed that all of a sudden my food, just as I concentrated on it, just seemed amazingly more flavorful, and my body just almost came up to greet it as it came into my mouth. And I, as a consequence, I actually did eat less, and I feel more satiated.
May I share a research study, a very quick one, that will bring home what you're talking about, because I verify everything I have found, and I'm saying, with research and actual studies, and I think you'll find this very relevant to what you just said.
Oh, please do.
A physician named Donald Morris did a study with meditating females, and he wanted to see if it changed the metabolism of food in some way. And so he fed them a high-carb diet, I don't remember exactly what the food was, but carbohydrate foods are plant-based foods, especially whole grains and beans and that kind of thing, but especially grains, cereal. And he had them meditate for 5 minutes before eating, and had another group just do mental arithmetic before eating. And the female students who meditated before eating produced 22% of an enzyme, which is a protein, in your saliva, which is where food and digestion starts in your mouth. And it's called D-alpha amylase, and D-alpha amylase helps you metabolize and break down carbohydrates. What a shock. 22% more D-alpha amylase in their saliva than the females who were doing mental arithmetic, task snacking, while eating or before eating. And so what this suggests is your consciousness that you bring to food, eating in a present, calm, mindful way, enhances the metabolism and digestion of food, meaning you're going to absorb more nutrients. The goal of Make Weight Loss Last, of the overeating styles I've developed and their antidotes, the goal with exercise, is to not think in terms of diet, 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 rigid, regimented, burn calories way of eating and living, but simply to move your body and enjoy the experience of eating, period. So you're not living in a stress-filled way. What's fascinating is, and this relates to the concepts in Make Weight Loss Last, My co-author is also my husband, Larry Sherwitz. And Dr. Larry Sherwitz was Dean Ornish's director of research for more than 18 years. And what we know is that people are always asking, which part of the four-part program is the best? Which one should I do? And most people think in terms of diet and exercise, but that's not the magic. The magic is all four components, practicing all four lifestyle change components. But what we found is those who did the most stress management every day, 1 to 2 hours, not just 5 seconds a day or 5-10 minutes, had the most regression and reversal of heart disease. Mm-hmm. So it's not just a matter of diet, gee, let's cut down on fat a little bit and amp up the exercise. We're talking about a whole different way of being in the world.
And in that, you're talking about heart disease per se, not losing weight.
But also obesity, because the entire program that I put together in Make Weight Loss Last, again, which is based on what has been for thousands of years, it's not a magic Deborah diet, is telling us that when you eat in a stressed out frame of mind, and when you exercise in a stressed out frame of mind, and you live your life in a stressed out frame of mind, perceived threat for what you can't get the project done on time, won't get to the appointment on time. Am I eating the right food, the best food? Is it good for me, bad for me? Oh, gee, I went off my diet. Oh, gee, I'm on my diet. All this stressor stuff that's so normal for all of us is stress. And ultimately, living that way and eating that way increases the odds of gaining weight instead of eating normally and enjoying the whole experience of eating and letting your body go to a normal weight.
Mm-hmm. And we should mention, we're talking with Deborah Keston. She's a nutritionist who worked with Dean Ornish on his anti-heart disease diet. Her book is Make Weight Loss Last, 10 Solutions That Nourish Body, Mind, and Soul. And we should mention that those four facets you talk about in the book are biological, so eating the right food and doing exercise, psychological, spiritual, and social. So let's talk a little bit about some of the things. How about the psychological? You talk about creating a positive relationship to food. What do you mean by that?
What I mean by a positive relationship to food is the opposite of how most of us relate to food and eating. And I want to, I'm going to answer your question specifically, but I really want to, my heart goes out to so many of us who have been taught to worry about food, to be concerned about eating the best food, the right food, whether it's healthful. We also have this concept in the culture, which when I first realized this, I was stunned, but it's, again, so normal for most of us. We project moral values onto food and how we eat. We have terms in the culture, I was good today, I was bad today, this food is really sinful, I shouldn't eat this, that word should, I should eat this. And again, this has become normal to us, but it's not normal. And again, projecting moral judgment on self and others around food has a profound impact on the whole experience of eating. So what I mean by a positive relationship to food, it means this. Although dieting and judging food as good or bad, anxiety about food, and thinking a lot about the best way to eat may not seem to have much in common, they are all characteristics of one of their overeating styles we've identified called food fretters. When fretting about food has become normal and dieting and being concerned about the best way to eat, this increases your odds of overeating and in turn weight gain.
Let's say, you know, it's Saturday night, you haven't really overindulged on sweets or even indulged in sweets for the week, and now you want to kind of give yourself a treat. You've got some homemade chocolate cake. It's got fat. It's got sugar. Are you saying that, you know, you could sit down and guiltlessly, mindfully eat a modest piece of cake?
What I'm saying is this. The optimal way to use nutritional science is to ask yourself, do you want to or need to eat to prevent, manage, or reverse an existing health problem? That's step number one. Here's the question. Do you want to prevent, or I want to eat to prevent something I'm at high risk for? Maybe both your parents had heart disease. Maybe both your parents are obese. There's diabetes in your family. Are you pre-diabetic? Do you have an existing health problem? That will help you determine the best way to eat. Use nutritional science that way. So if you are healthy and you don't need a particular special diet and way to eat, a regimented way to eat, and your most of the time way of eating is what I describe as fresh whole food, meaning fruits and veggies and whole grains and legumes and nuts and seeds, and fresh dairy, fish, meat, and poultry, meaning not pepperoni and not sausage and not bacon and not chicken McNuggets, fresh whole lean animal-based foods, then sure, go ahead and enjoy the carrot cake instead of the carrot. It's not the carrot cake on Saturday night or the chocolate chip cookies on Saturday night. It's what you're eating most of the rest of the time and what your health concerns are.
Well, that's a relief.
You know, to answer your question on a larger scope, Francesca, I have a question to pose to you, if I may.
Sure.
Would you share with me, with your listeners, a memorable, wonderful meal that you had sometime? Does anything come to mind?
Oh, absolutely.
Tell me.
Well, first of all, it was in the south of France. So right there, you know that it was probably a very good meal, and it was. It was a celebration of the winter solstice, so December 21st. I was invited to a magnificent meal cooked by a couple. The man was, in fact, a private chef, so like he was a magnificent cook. Everything was laid out really beautifully. There was a lot of food, more than people would eat generally. There was very congenial conversation. I met new people I liked. I got to eat with older friends, like my friends who had invited me. And it was, you know, one of the high culinary experiences of my life. And it probably took about 3 hours.
Well, what you're describing is exactly what I am talking about in Make Weight Loss Last. When I ask people to describe a memorable, wonderful meal, they describe what you just did. Wonderful fresh food, wonderful atmosphere. You weren't looking at the plate and counting calories and portion sizes. The people around you were wonderful. You weren't having a fight. You weren't sitting at your computer. You were eating when you were eating, and it makes food and eating one of life's most pleasurable, delightful experiences more often than not. The antithesis is what's normal in this culture, which is eating alone, eating while driving in your car or at your computer, not eating fresh, wonderful food that was made with regard, but food, I call it food products, foodish food. Most people call it fast food, processed food, denatured food. Our friend Bruce Milliman, who's a naturopathic physician, calls it ersatz food. It's kind of sort of like food, but it's an imitation of the original. So when I ask people and ask you, share your most memorable dining experience, it's never, gee, I was planning a binge, I was lonely, I was driving home in my car, I stopped at 7-Eleven, and I don't know, I got 3 bags of corn chips and a pint of ice cream and zoned out in front of my TV by myself, which is what's happening with many people in this country.
And yet I will have to say, there were 3 desserts and there was no skimping on the fat.
And it was delicious.
Yes.
And I'm saying it's normal to feast. It is normal. We evolved. Everything we discovered and that I've written about is about how we evolved as human beings and how we ate and our relationship to food over the millennia, thousands of years. And part of that is when we were lucky, when in the hunter-gatherer era, when the hunter was lucky enough to get a, I don't know, get some wild game or an animal, kill an animal, it was a huge feast. It's normal to feast. Did humankind, did human beings do that every day? Nuh-uh. But I'm saying one of life's greatest pleasures is feasting with fresh, delicious food and friends and just enjoying it. Every day, not normal, but it's a great pleasure. That's why, you know, we always get so many questions from, I do, from the media, how can you not gain weight over the holidays? And my suggestion is that's the time to put on a pound or two or whatever. It's what are you eating the rest of the year, and how are you eating the rest of the year?
And yet, I think many of your suggestions, Deborah Keston, in this book, Make Weight Loss Last, can also help us during the holidays. One of them is focus on your food. I mean, that's certainly something we can do. Although, when we are with other people, I suppose we're also having conversation. But I find somehow it's easy to have conversation and also focus and enjoy your food. I'm not sure why that isn't multitasking, but somehow it works.
Well, it kind of, you could get very literal, and it kind of is to be with other people, talking, chatting. Multitasking, though, we call it task snacking, eating while doing other things and other activities. What that does, it diverts the digestion of your food. We talked a bit about that before with Donald Morse's experiment. But the concept is, I'm going to tell you another study that kind of ties a lot of this together, eating mindfully with other people, pleasant atmosphere. Stunning study, but fascinating. A researcher named Nerum, N-E-R-E-M, took some rabbits. This is about, I don't know, 2 decades ago. He took some rabbits, and he fed them a high atherosclerotic diet. He wanted to see if a high-fat, high-cholesterol diet would cause plaque in the arteries. And when he looked at the results, he found out that 2/3 of the rabbits had heart disease, quite severe heart disease, and about 1/3 of them didn't have any or very little buildup of clogged arteries. And he couldn't figure out what happened, and he retraced his steps, and he found out the rabbits were being kept in cages, and the diminutive, petite research assistant who was feeding the rabbits would take out the rabbits in the middle cages and hold them while she fed them. And those were the rabbits that did not develop clogged arteries. So what I'm suggesting about this is, again, eating in a pleasant atmosphere with other people that you like, not having a family fight or whatever, or driving in your car, eating with others in a pleasant atmosphere affects the way foods metabolize. It's the mystery of life.
Wow.
Wow. That was my response.
And Deborah Keston, there's one area we haven't talked about yet, and that's sleep. And I have some questions about that. I have heard, as you do say in your book, Make Weight Loss Last, that, you know, not getting enough sleep can cause weight gain. And I'm going to ask you to explain exactly how that happens. Explain to us the connection between lack of sleep and weight gain.
Again, it comes back to hormones. If you are not getting enough sleep, the hormones in your body are not effectively processing the glucose, which is another word for sugar, in your body. And basically what happens is the sleep more, weigh less formula that I'm suggesting, and many other people are suggesting, it's not my original research, it may seem simple, but a closer look reveals that the picture isn't so black and white. A researcher named Sanjay Patel did a 16-year project, and he found that those who sleep 7 hours, usually between 7 to 8 hours, don't gain as much weight. And again, it comes back to the hormone link, because we're talking about naturally occurring low levels, for example, of progesterone, which is a hormone that many women are familiar with, estrogen and progesterone, can lead to a sense of being on edge. And when you're not getting enough sleep, again, the endocrine system starts producing an imbalance of cortisol, which goes up. And the key concept is your body isn't processing the glucose that's circulating in your body 24/7. It's what gives your body and brain energy. And when your glucose metabolism is out of whack, so is the rest of your body, your sleep, your weight.
And that's what's involved with diabetes, of course.
That's what's involved with diabetes, absolutely. 7 to 8 hours seems to be the magic number, 7 to 7.5 hours. This is linked to, for example, have you heard the guideline? People who tend to be a normal weight have breakfast in the morning. Eat breakfast, eat breakfast, eat breakfast. That's because during the night when you're sleeping, you're, for most of us, unless you have binge eating disorder, which is a whole other interview, most of us are sleeping and we're not eating for 7 or 8 hours. And during that time, that means you're not putting food in your body that's going to help keep your sugar, your glucose levels balanced. And so when you wake up in the morning, your glucose levels are very low. And having breakfast and having the vitamins and minerals that your body needs are going to help keep your glucose and insulin levels balanced, insulin, another hormone. Bottom line is balancing insulin, insulin, insulin.
And the message I'm also getting is that balance in other ways is good. You know, moderation in sleep, moderation in eating, you know, an occasional feast, but keeping an even keel, that's what can keep us from, especially the kind of yo-yo patterns in which people lose a lot of weight and then gain even more back. Is that right?
Yes, and I'm suggesting diet in the original ancient sense of the word. The word diet comes from diete in Latin and Greek, and it originally meant way of life. And Hippocrates, the godfather of medicine, he defined it as a way of living and eating. And what I'm suggesting throughout our whole discussion is to relate to diet and food as a way of living, not as something to be scared of, not counting calories, not obsessing about it, not task snacking. We haven't been eating with others in a pleasant atmosphere. This is how we evolved, and it's how most of us relate to food in a pleasurable way, which is not a word that pleasure that we bring to food in this country. You know, something that we haven't mentioned is also emotional eating, which is eating usually out of negative emotions, anger and loneliness or anxiety. And the antidote to that is to access your appetite, to be aware of feelings before, during, and after eating. Be aware of feelings before, during, and after eating. Instead of just feeling anxious or depressed and turning to food to help with that, comfort food, you've heard that term. Mm-hmm. And food really is comfort food. The reason we turn to a carrot cake instead of a carrot when we're feeling anxious is that when you eat carbohydrates, carrot cake or anything with sugar, white flour, it takes about 20 minutes for your mind body to get the message. But when you eat carbohydrate foods, which is what most people turn to when they're an emotional eater, it releases a naturally occurring substance in your brain called serotonin. And serotonin is a naturally occurring hormone that calms and relaxes you. And that's why many people turn to carbohydrates when they're feeling depressed or anxious or lonely or whatever. It's soothing, and it really works.
This is very linked, I think, to something else you talk about, which is food addiction.
Food addiction, brand new study came out with Kelly Brownell, who's an obesity expert, writes about the toxic food environment in this country. And food addiction is very real. When you have an ongoing flood of certain substances like serotonin and you cut off the flow, your body needs it and you do crave foods. It's more than a food craving. It can actually be an addiction.
Well, this has been really fascinating, Deborah Keston. I think we've come to the end of our time here, but I encourage our listeners to check out your book, Make Weight Loss Last, 10 Solutions That Nourish Body, Mind, and Soul. And by the way, I really do like the the way you balance science and an understanding of the body-mind. So you're kind of bringing both the spiritual traditions and the your own experiences as a nutritionist together. Thanks so much for talking with us here.
My pleasure. I would like to just add one other point, please. I have a website called MakeWeightLossLast.com, and on it there's a free whole-person nutrition program about how to eat optimally that brings in many of these concepts.
Oh, wonderful. Okay, and we will link to that from our website at writersvoice.net. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Deborah Keston is a nutrition researcher, educator, and coach who specializes in preventing and reversing obesity and heart disease. She was a nutritionist on Dr. Dean Ornish's first clinical trial for reversing heart disease through lifestyle changes. In addition to Make Weight Loss Last, she's the author of Feeding the Body, Nourishing the Soul, and The Healing Secrets of Food. Go to writersvoice.net for a link to her website about her approach. Next up, I'll bring you my story about that wonderful meal in the south of France I mentioned earlier. Stay tuned after the break.
En los pies, mal aliento sale de mi boca, palabras de fetidez. Este pelo pica, barbacita perezosa. Soy una oruga que nunca muda en mariposa. No quiero que me vean, no quiero que me oigan. Quiero quedarme desconocido. No quiero que me vean, no quiero que me oigan.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. As you heard earlier, there is one special meal in my life that stands out as a peak experience, a dinner party in southern France in honor of the winter solstice, held at the house of two dear friends of mine. We'll call them Michel, the chef, and his wife Magali. The food was divine, the wine likewise, and the company convivial. And I ended up learning a profound lesson about the French art of living and eating. I wrote up my experience in the story, The Food Philosophe. In what follows, I read from the story, and I'm also joined by former Writer's Voice co-host Daisy Mathias, who plays the part of Magali. The action begins with my friend Fabienne, who had introduced me to Michel and Magali and accompanied me to the dinner.
Dans le petit bois, de trousse chemise, quand la mer est grise et qu'on l'est un peu.
Fabienne unwrapped a large black truffle from its napkin with a mysterious smile. Everybody oohed and aahed. She laid it on a plate so it could be passed around the company for inspection. I lifted it hesitantly to my nose, not wanting to violate some unspoken rule of etiquette. It had a delicate and alluring scent, surprising, an unlikely mix of hints of turpentine and something musky and erotic. The round completed, Fabienne shaved dark slivers of the fungus onto crackers, which she handed to us as if they were the Holy Communion. Mine almost wafted to my lips. I nibbled cautiously. The savor was subtle. To tell the truth, one might even say faint. The truffle was a trifle immature, but no matter. Mystique trumped taste. It was the first time I had ever seen the rare delicacy, much less eaten one. Murmurs of appreciation rippled through the assembled guests. Then we sat down to eat in earnest. I had arrived at Michel and Magali's house in Op 2 days ago, but my hosts had had little time for me. Magali had been preparing the elaborate decorations. Michel, a professional chef who cooked for private clients in the region, had spent much of the time at the stove or the chopping block, obsessed, like an alchemist in his study. I had hovered on the margin like an anthropologist, observing native rituals. He was a man of many sides and a checkered past. He didn't fit easily into any categories. For one, he'd spent close to a decade in prison during his youth. The details were never really clear, but it had something to do with the underworld gangs in Marseille. He would have looked the part, too, were it not for his warmth and ebullient nature. He had a street tough's body, all barreled and bandy-legged, and his temper could be fierce. The tenaciousness of his grudges was legendary. The one time I crossed him, it took a good deal of bowing and scraping on my part before he let me back into his good graces. Assiduous watering of the flower of friendship with viticultural gifts didn't hurt either. But it was worth it. Michel has one of those hearts so capacious that it stretches its membrane to an overly fragile extent and can become all too easily pierced.
You are the one for me, for me, for me, formidable. You are my love, very, 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 very tall.
The day of the feast, the guests assembled around 1 o'clock in the afternoon. The first to arrive was a wealthy couple that ran a local chambre d'hôte. The husband, a red-faced, voluble man, was retired from the plumbing fixtures trade. Within minutes of his entrance, he had already boasted that of every 3 bidets in France, one of them was his. His wife, a stylish woman with a nervous, squinting tic and clenched jaw, amused the company with her acerbic, witty patter. When the guests had all arrived, we sat down at our designated places. The company broke out of the starter line with champagne and canapés, rounded the first corner with Fabienne's truffle, then settled in for the long stretch. First the entree, a traditional cream tart, this one of leek. It was followed by a simple salad seasoned with a perfect vinaigrette. Then came the meat dish, bouffard de marinière du Rhône, that is, beef marinated for 3 days and simmered in wine. I understood the marinière du Rhône, a kind of pun with marinated and sailors of the Rhône, but the word bouffard escaped me. Later I tried to find it in my French dictionary, but the closest match I could come up with was bouffer, to guzzle or feed like an animal. A description, I suppose, of the kind of behavior the dish inspired, at least in me. Then the cheese course, camembert, oozing its arterial poison, and some locally made goat cheese, runny with age and topped with herbe de Provence. The desserts followed, note the plural, butter cookies à la maison, chocolate tubes filled with Grand Marnier, apple compote, and homemade sugared almonds. The meal was topped off by coffee, followed by liqueur as a digestive tonic. After the successful conclusion of the meal allowed him to relax, Michel stood in front of the hearth, sipping his coffee. An expression of deep satisfaction wreathed his face. I joined him as he reflected on the event. "Do you know how it was all done?" he asked me, raising his bushy eyebrows in a rhetorical flourish as we toasted our backs at the fireplace, espresso cups in hand. I shook my head no. "It is a combination of the book, I never invent a recipe," he paused to underscore the interjection, stubby finger raised, "time and love. And of all these, the last is the most important." I always loved it when Michel regaled me with his philosophical observations. His views percolated in a pungent stew of anarchism, quasi-Buddhism, and evangelical Christianity, a combination that never ceased to intrigue me with its unexpected and always strong flavors. "Tell me more," I prompted him. "It is a pleasure to give, to share with others," he said, as if it were self-evident. He paused and then continued. "But there is something else, the hidden part." "What's that?" "Ego," His beetle brows flew up to punctuate the remark. "Oh, yes," I concurred, although I wasn't sure where he was going. "There's always ego." Of course," he drawled archly. "I am no different than the others." We each took the glass of digestive tonic that someone handed us in passing. "When you start to cook for people that you don't really like all that much," Michelle resumed, "you say, 'Aha, I'm going to show them.'" He seemed to be leading in the direction of a moral message, but I couldn't imagine what that might be. "What does that do to your cooking?" I asked him. "It deteriorates it. I am, in fact, trying to punish the customer. My sentiment is, I'm going to show this jerk. But the jerk is me." I chewed his comment over. He waited for me to digest it. "You're saying there's a spiritual lesson here about egotism?" I ventured finally. "Yes," he answered. "Well, it is not just egotism. More precisely, it is a lack of love." He thought for a moment. "Of course, you cannot love everyone. If you had to love all your guests, being a professional chef could get complicated. Balance was surely being called for here, a scaling back of spiritual expectations. But you can cook for people you don't love without this idea of showing them, punishing them with your expertise, as it were, can't you?" I asked. "Yes, but only after you have understood this phenomenon. When you've learned a little humilité." Humility is a virtue. Gluttony is a sin. Paying my sinner's dues, I finally succumbed to the surfeit of food and drink. Soon after my talk with Michelle, the force of gravity propelled me to the living room couch, pinning me supine by the weight of my stomach. Once there, it was a long time before I could bend sufficiently to attain the requisite angle to get up. While resting there, I mulled over Michelle's comments. I wondered which religious tradition was reflected in his thinking about humility. It seemed more Buddhist than Christian, or maybe it came out of the place where all spiritual traditions meet, the place where long years of discipline and practice dissolve the ego with the enlightenment that mastery brings. Foodism, like Buddhism, is just one of many pathways to nirvana. Buddhism says that life is suffering, and comprehension of that truth is the prerequisite to true happiness. I have no dispute with this teaching, as it counsels the wisdom of acceptance, but is it not as true that life is pleasure and happiness reposes in its enjoyment? As long as the pleasure hurts nothing and no one, and particularly when it feeds the soul as well as the senses. The meal Michelle and Magali shared with me and the other guests was Epicurean, not in the self-indulgent, gluttonous sense of the term today, but in the spirit of Epicurus himself, the enjoyment of simple pleasures shared with friends. Michelle himself had a profound interest in the spiritual dimensions of food. He called it the philosophie d'alimentation. One morning, several months after our winter feast, Michelle, Magali, and I were breakfasting on some chewy fresh rolls from the market and Magali's homemade mulberry jam as the spring birds sang their little hearts out in the olive grove next to the patio. Michelle took up the theme again. "You are what you eat," he stated with an air of inviting questions and comments. "You mean biologically?" No. I mean it spiritually. But it is not just what you eat, but more importantly, how you eat." I mumbled encouragingly through my crumbs for him to continue. "You pay attention. You add a little salt. You think about what you're eating. You see what I mean?" Magali chimed in.
"Yes, because there are people who eat just to supply themselves with nourishment."
Michelle interjected.
"To fill themselves up?"
"They pay absolutely no attention. They eat anything."
"The consciousness disabled," Michelle snorted. "Do you mean buffet?" I was proud to use this newly learned word. Eating like an animal? Voila! He took out his tobacco pouch and began rolling a cigarette. A lot of Americans eat like that, I said, thinking of my own guilt in that regard.
Yes, and that's why you have the problem of obesity in America. C'est dramatique, and it's beginning to appear in France. At the school, you see this kind of espèce de merde of chocolate bar.
Magali inserted.
McDo, too, with all the sugary drinks.
She was talking about McDonald's. I shook my head sadly. I was thinking yesterday that here in France, people have it so good. The food, the good company around the table. Why do they want to do things the American way? Especially the worst of it.
Well, it's very easily explained, Michelle told me. It's because America is a myth. The American dream.
All the young people dream of going to America.
Of course, Michelle exclaimed with sarcastic levity. All the children of the middle and upper classes want to take a tour of America. It's a must.
He pulled on his cigarette and blew an exasperated smoke ring into the air.
Well, they also go to learn the language.
They could go to England for that, I commented.
Now Michelle laughed scornfully.
It's the same thing. In England, they eat like pigs.
He tipped his chair dangerously back and puffed another smoke ring.
Yeah, fish and chips, I joined him in derision. Oh,
he brought the chair's front legs down with a thud.
Now that's fantastic. The fish and chips are fantastic.
The mood became suddenly giddy. Magali waxed positively rhapsodic on American fare.
And you know, the hamburger and the hot dogs with sauerkraut and mustard, oh la la, that's also really good, from time to time.
Michelle looked at me and shrugged his shoulders.
You see, in France, they cannot resist it. They love the hamburgers at McDonald's, and the French sandwiches totally lack imagination. It's always ham with butter, ham with butter.
His lips pursed a disdainful grimace.
You can't find a good sandwich here. It is not possible.
And so, sated with good food and conversation, and buoyed by the leaven of internationalist goodwill, we concluded our repast. Like a fine meal, Michelle's lessons in the French art of gourmandise required time to savor and digest. I've come back to them again and again, catching myself wolfing down my fare, already living in the next instead of the present moment, or stuffing myself with an overlarge portion set in front of me, ensnared in the illusion that quantity is equivalent to quality. Then I imagine Michelle looking at me from under his beetle brows with an expression of amused remonstrance, and I slow down to taste what I'm taking in.
À 18 ans, j'ai quitté ma province, bien décidé à empoigner la vie. Le cœur léger et le bagage mince, j'étais certain de conquérir Paris. Chez le tailleur le plus chic, j'ai fait faire ce complet bleu qui était du dernier cri. Les photos, les chansons et les orchestrations ont eu raison de mes économies.
That was my story, The Food Philosophe. If you want to read it in its entirety, go to writersvoice.net. Next up, Drew Adamek has a review of all the art that's fit to print and some that wasn't inside the New York Times op-ed page. And he talks with the author, Jarell Krauss.
Jarell Krauss was the New York Times op-ed page art director for 13 years, the longest tenure at that position for anyone at the New York Times. Over the course of a 30-year career with the Times, She helped usher in a new era of op-ed art that deepened the impact of opinion writers, current affairs reporting, and editorials. Her new book, All the Art That's Fit to Print and Some That Wasn't, Inside the New York Times Op-Ed Page, chronicles her time as the art director for the op-ed page. But this book is so much more than a simple biography. It is a lush and richly illustrated history of iconic imagery that evokes the most important events of the last 30 years. What is op-ed art and illustration? While one may not notice it, every day, the opinion pages of newspapers are filled with doodles, small illustrations, large images, and occasionally full-page-sized art that relates to and deepens the text. In the case of the New York Times, that art was often done by famous artists such as Ralph Steadman, Maurice Sendak, Charles Adams, and Keith Haring. For All the Art That's Fit to Print, Krauss has collected, in one volume, over 300 of these images from over 100 artists and put them together chronologically with her personal commentary, professional insight, and offers background on their creation, popular reception, and often editorial rejection. However, there are no political cartoons or caricatures in this collection. Rather, the art contained is illustrative of the ideas and themes of articles of opinion. A story on Henry Kissinger's war crimes may be accompanied by an image of him covered in bloody tattoos, or a story about George W. Bush's abilities may show him cheating on an eye exam. However, the real treasure of this book is the art that was rejected by editors for failing to meet the time's strict and sometimes Puritan standards. Krauss includes almost 100 images that were rejected for either being too political, too racy, or too obtuse. A reader feels like an insider at the editorial battles that must have raged minutes before deadline as she details the thinking and arguments behind the rejections. All the Art That's Fit to Print is about the storytelling power of art. The truly beautiful part of reading this is the instant recognition of important events and people in our history that is contained in a single powerful image. I spoke to Jarrell about putting this book together, why Henry Kissinger got a free pass from the Times, and the power of art to move us in ways words alone cannot. Thank you so much for joining us, Jarrell.
Thank you, Drew. I'm very pleased to be with you.
So when I first received the email about this book, I had in my head that it was going to be sort of a dry biographical retelling of your time at the New York Times. But that's not the case at all. I was quite pleasantly surprised, but will you talk about what exactly this book is?
You did get the parenthetical phrase, and some that wasn't. All the Art That's Fit to Print and some that wasn't inside the New York Times, right? Because that's the kind of kicker. In other words, I publish things that have never been seen before and that editors killed because, and this is sort of the basic fun premise of the book. I wanted to preserve some of the things that you know, would either be published and seen for one day or, in fact, never seen at all because they were killed by editors who were afraid that they were politically incorrect, sexually over the line, or, you know, offensive in some way to family readers at breakfast, which is how they used to think of the Times. I think it's quite different now, considering it's all digital as well.
You mentioned in the book that prominent figures can't be satirized in the Times any more than grenades can be joked about at airport security. How did you, as art director of the op-ed page for 13 years, how did you walk that fine line of doing the job of the op-ed page and yet staying within Times decorum?
What I ran into is the notion that what you can write journalistically is far more explicit and graphic than what you can show graphically, literally, and that is that you can talk about blood and guts and you know, dying and killing and sex, and but you can't show those things. You know, you cannot show those things in a paper such as the Times. Good example is what I have on the cover, which is a Kissinger image that was done for a William Pfaff article, who was stating, even in 1979, what a war criminal Kissinger is. So I was really proud of the art I got by David Levine, a very famous and very gifted artist. He did this wonderful image of Kissinger actually naked, but that wasn't the point. It was the point to show his war crimes as tattoos on his back. So you see Vietnam darkening, you see bombs falling on Cambodia, you know, the secret bombing that he and Nixon did. This is what we showed graphically, and no matter how powerful and how scathing, really, Drew, that article was, you know, the idea that we couldn't show something relatively powerful as art to go with it is the disturbing thing. And, you know, I found out ultimately, I think the real reason that Kissinger, that wonderful Kissinger image that I put on the cover, was banished to David Levine's great, you know, furor, and my great disappointment, was that the Times actually, I'm sure the bottom line is that Times people, the Times brass, know Kissinger.
In the book, you say that while the texts reach the brain's logical left lobe, it's the art that links directly to the cerebrum's right hemisphere, which processes mm-hmm. intuitively, visually, and subliminally. And mm-hmm. in reading this book, I kept that in mind. And can you talk about art's ability to tell and connect to a deeper story? Because I think that was really the thing that was fascinating to me about this book, was seeing this art and understanding the story deeper and the text deeper.
Well, Drew, that's a very good question. I appreciate that a lot, because that's kind of key. The power of art, especially art by very intelligent people who add to the article, you know, that was the idea of this artist, to add and deepen the article, you know, give it context and not just literally illustrate. You know, in the Norman Rockwell days, there were kind of two kinds of illustration. There was literal narrative, you know, taking something from the article and just drawing it, and then there was decorative illustration. But this is conceptual illustration. We had to create, or the op-ed page created, you know, it reaches a viewer in a powerful way, and the viewer, us reading, looking, we end up, you know, when we come across these images that are so iconic, we feel the power of the image, and it enhances our reading of the article, but maybe stays with us even more strongly. That's what I meant. It stays with us in a maybe unconscious, as I say, subliminal way, and that we don't forget that image.
I've been talking to Jarell Krauss, author of All the Art That's Fit to Print and Some That Wasn't, Inside the New York Times. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Drew. I've enjoyed it.
That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight into your inbox or subscribe to the free podcast and newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon, at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. Drew Adamek is Writer's Voice Associate Producer. Our webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.